Jim Fusilli is many things. He's an award-winning mystery writer. He has also written a book on Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys album Pet Sounds. He writes for the Wall Street Journal as a pop music critic, and he's also served as an occasional contributor to NPR's All Things Considered. He's on with us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. Jim, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
Let me ask you for your personal reflections. First, it seems like a good place to start. If you, as a teen, I suppose, born in 53, you were a young teen when Simon and Garfunkel was coming out. Was this music that caught your ear at all back then?
No, I wasn't a big Simon and Garfunkel fan. I never really got into the sort of poetry thing. I wasn't a big fan of folk music. I got into the work of Simon and Garfunkel once I began to appreciate the solo work of Paul Simon. Then I went back and took a look at it and saw what made it great. But I found it to be a little bit precocious and far away from the stuff coming out of San Francisco and the blues-based stuff that was coming out of the UK and the sort of very beginning stages of heavy metal. I really didn't get Simon and Garfunkel.
Well, when you went back to take a second look, what did you appreciate about what they were doing? Let's break it down into the, you know, earliest two or three albums.
Well, I think Paul Simon is an extraordinary songwriter. I think there are very few people of the rock era who have a body of work as substantial as his and of a consistently high quality. And those songs that he wrote for Simon and Garfunkel in the beginning are very poetic. I mean, the imagery is very strong. They're very clear about what he's trying to say and the type of lives he's talking about. That's the first thing that strikes me about the Simon and Garfunkel work. The second is just how wonderful their two voices sounded together. They had a very pleasing way of bringing forth two-part harmony. They had very round tones. The voices worked well together. They were obviously committed to communicating what Simon had written with the two voices. It was beautifully done. And there is a seriousness to the work that I probably didn't appreciate when I was very young, but I appreciate now. And it's funny because you can almost hear Paul Simon pulling away from that introspective seriousness as he moves along, as they get to bookends. But, you know, he wrote about some pretty heavy stuff at a young age, and I think he nailed it pretty well. I mean, songs like Dangling Conversation and Kathy's Song, you know, they say it pretty well.
When you just listed those three elements, the first one you said was something, you ended it by saying, you know, the stories or the people that he was portraying, what were they? How would you articulate, you know, what slice of life he was trying to represent?
Well, I think Paul Simon was writing about himself, but in writing about himself, he also wrote about a lot of people who felt disenfranchised, who felt alone, who didn't really understand the tumult around them. I always got the sense that Paul Simon felt he was out of step with the world around him. And I think that's reflected in the songs of Simon and Garfunkel. I think that this is a man who is somewhat alone, regardless of the tumult and the crowd around him.
And do you think in 65 through 67, specifically, I mean, this is too an easy connect the dots, but it's, you know, why is that appealing to people who are buying pop records and albums then?
Well, I'm not quite sure it was appealing to as many people as it might have been. I think because it had such a specific point of view, and it was essentially the point of view of one alienated man, that it didn't have a universality that some of the other music of the time had. But I do think when a Paul Simon song strikes a chord within the listener, it strikes it at a very deep and profound level. So I think there's a passion for his work, a lasting passion, a lasting identification with the songs that he's written that may not be true of some of the other music that was more popular at the time.
And Paul's history, he was kind of dragged back into the spotlight. He'd sort of given up the hope of having the kind of success that came to him when Sounds of Silence was remixed, wasn't it? Wasn't he in England settling into being a traveling troubadour?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about the Simon and Garfunkel emergence is that Paul Simon withdrawing from the pop scene of the time and trying to bring a different type of sensibility to folk music, and then withdrawing completely because there was really no place for him to hang his hat. It is kind of interesting that Tom Wilson took the Sounds of Silence tape, added a certain pop element to it, and sort of found a way for Simon to communicate, even though Simon may not have gotten there by himself.
Yeah, and evidently was horrified when he first heard it. But then, you know, when he comes back into that world, he had quite a bit of experience in the early days learning how to craft, you know, catchy tunes, pop records that seemed to serve him well as he, you know, entered that factory in a way.
Well, the thing about Paul Simon and the thing about rock musicians whose work will last is they have at a foundation the ability to do what you would think would be obvious to most people, is that Paul Simon can write, he can sing, and he can play. You know, he is a gifted musician that if he was sitting in your living room across from you, could mesmerize you with his ability to communicate. He is a fully developed and gifted musician, and he probably was that at the time the first Simon and Garfunkel albums came out. So he had the confidence that rises from the ability to do what you want to do through your talent.
Do you have a memory of a concert experience seeing him? You know, maybe in your 20s he was starting to play as a solo artist. Did you ever cross paths?
Yeah, I saw Paul Simon many, many, many times. He was an inspiration for me, not just as somebody who was toying around with the idea of being a musician, but somebody who was more serious about becoming a writer. I loved his respect for words. I loved the way he created characters and scenario. And I just really thought he was very gifted. There were a lot of writers at that time who were doing some serious writerly stuff. You know, Joni Mitchell comes to mind, or Leonard Cohen, or... And I thought Simon was the best of them. I really thought that he knew how to create a world and create a character in that world and communicate it. So when you would see him in concert, you know, they were a hit or miss thing. I think Paul Simon's concerts were often hit or miss. I don't think he was really comfortable in the beginning being by himself on the stage. Now, let me rephrase that. I don't think in the beginning he was comfortable being on stage with a band. I think he was very comfortable being alone, just him and his guitar and his song. But when he was operating at the peak of his abilities as a solo artist, he could send a laser beam into your soul and talk about something that you knew was exactly right, that was exactly true, that the people he was writing about, the world in which they lived, was a world that you knew and didn't quite understand as well as he did.
Would you be willing or able to give an example of a song where he especially does that especially well?
Well, if you look at that first album, I mean, I think people remember, you know, Mother and Child Reunion and Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard. But... if you listen to a song like Peace Like a River, it's a remarkable piece of music. I mean, the lyrics are fabulous. The guitar playing is extraordinary. It has a point of view that's unlike anything else, certainly on that album. The one thing about Paul Simon is he never shied away from experimenting with lyrics and points of view. And I think that Peace Like a River is an example of that. I think Duncan is another example of that. That's a song that, I mean, I was 19 at the time when that came out. And this is a rootless young man who's sort of stumbling through life, looking for something to hang his hat on. And the fact that he can play a little bit of music gives him a handhold in the world. It's a wonderful job by Simon on that song.
Yeah, I've always been attracted to that song. I mean, just the vignettes just feel so convincing, so real. You know, when you were talking about it, he feels like, or he conveys somehow that he really knows these people well enough to write their story. That always came through in that song to me.
Yeah, and I think on and on it goes. I think some of the albums that are less popular in his canon, like Hearts and Bones, for example, mm-hmm. there are some extraordinary revealing songs on that album. The title track is extraordinary. It's about the breakup of his marriage to Carrie Fisher. And if you listen to it, and you've ever lost somebody that you love, or you've made a decision to walk away from a situation that didn't work out the way that you hoped it would, you can sense that he's really nailed it. He's really understood what has happened to him, and he knows how to tell you what happened to him.
Yeah, I'd put that right up at the top myself, that particular track. Before we leave the early solo albums, the first one or two, any other observations or tracks that stand out about his developing craft at that time that sort of takes him a broad step away from Simon and Garfunkel and sets him on his way?
Well, if you look at There Goes Rhymin' Simon, the second album, well, the first album has a lot of different types of music on it. There's that instrumental he plays with Stepan Grappelli. But the second album really shows him just about trying anything he wants to. There's gospel on it. There's reggae. There's a couple of great folk tunes. There's a little bit of experimentation with New Orleans music. And he's pretty fearless at this point. And I just love that. I love when an artist is confident and not afraid to show that confidence, not in an arrogant way or an off-putting way, but in a way that shows he's willing to take great risk. And he knows that there's something to lose here, but nonetheless, he takes that risk anyway, and when it works, it's wonderful.
When you saw him the first time or first couple times as a solo artist, can you paint a picture of you know, what that looked like, what he looked like, what your memory is of that, if it's not too hazy?
Yeah, I actually went to see Paul Simon the night after my senior prom in high school at Carnegie Hall, and he just struck me as a regular guy walking out on the stage. I mean, one of the great things about being a New Yorker is that, you know, he was one of us, and he looked like, you know, any of a dozen people you passed on the street on the way to the concert hall. And, you know, he was kind of a little guy, and the guitar always looked big. From whenever I watched him play the guitar, it always looked big in his hands. And he could just absolutely dazzle. I mean, he was a flawless guitar player, singing these great songs and just standing up there and doing it. I really admired that.
What about the quality of his voice? Any thoughts about how to articulate why it is so appealing?
Well, I think he's been inconsistent as a singer. I think he's done some really nice singing, and I think he's done some really bad singing. I don't think much of him as a crooner, but I think, you know, very few people can sing a folk song as well as he can. And I don't know that anybody can sing the words he's written as well as he can.
So what of the Graceland period? Is there a way to talk about how and why this connected with audiences? As you know, why Hearts and Bones didn't, but why Graceland did?
Well, again, I think Simon was there grappling with how to communicate at a period where music was changing. That sort of crooning folk rock thing that he was doing, it was dying. For me, it couldn't have died fast enough. I mean, it was really, you know, to see Paul Simon crooning like Perry Como wasn't something that I really wanted to be in close proximity to. But you know, Hearts and Bones. Wait, let me do this again, because I like this point. Okay, I think Paul Simon went through a period where he didn't really know how to communicate what he wanted to communicate. I thought he was really too deep in the middle of the road, crooning his songs. You know, that's still crazy after all these years period. I'm not sure that that's a wonderful period for his work and the way to communicate. And when that died, when people lost interest in that, I was really glad. One Trick Pony and Hearts and Bones were a way for him to add a little bit more bounce, a little bit more heft to his music. But he was really working with music of the past at that point. And I think he was really grappling to find a new way to communicate. And I think the music of South Africa gave that to him. You know, I spent some time with him during the Graceland period. And I know that he was completely energized by the music of South Africa. And he saw in it a connection to the music that he loved as a kid, the doo-wop music. He just saw this unbridled, joyful way to communicate. He just saw this unbridled way to communicate the joy one felt when making music.
Right, and the vocalizing of Ladysmith Black Mambazo and some of the other folks he collaborated with on that period.
Well, I do think that Paul Simon approaches making records as a musician. And I think he was in love with some of the other players. I think he loved Ray Peary. I think he loved Bukidi Kumalo. I think he loved the percussion that you could get. He just loved the way that the people played guitar in South Africa. And he saw that he fit with them very well, because guitar was the sort of basis of his music too. And he loved percussion, and he loved motion in music. So all of these things fit very well with what he wanted to do. You know, it's not a huge leap from One Trick Pony to some of the stuff on Graceland. It's just that the underpinning is different. The underpinning is coming from a different culture. But the ideas of bringing 50s R&B back is something that he was trying to do. And he just could take it a different place with the Graceland musicians.
Is the flavor of the writing appreciably different from... I mean, I know that, you know, it's not like one door closes and the other one opens, as you point out. It is a process. But, I mean, when you look at it sort of in terms of Simon and Garfunkel era, early Paul Simon solo era, and then where, you know, a lot of people start checking Paul Simon out again in the mid-80s, you know, what are they hearing lyrically that's maybe different? If so, if you think there is something there.
Well, I think that he had written some of those songs before he came in contact with the South African musicians, and I think he rewrote some of the lyrics after he had the experience of going to South Africa and meeting some of the people. You know, I think he always was somebody who had a point of view and was writing from a personal point of view, but was able to reflect the world around him. So I don't find it unusual that he would make reference to the experiences he had with those musicians and going to South Africa.
Mm-hmm. And then what survives from what you've mentioned about these, you know, different moments in his career that you can clearly see on Surprise, his latest record?
Again, it's Paul Simon on Surprise is trying to find the right way to communicate in a contemporary setting. He takes a hard look at himself and understands that people are listening to different things now, and he wants to be able to communicate with the listener. He's fascinating in this way, in that he makes concessions to the marketplace but never surrenders his distinct point of view.
Yeah, one of my folks said somehow he does that without selling out. I mean, that was his way of saying it. You know, he's commercial without selling out, I think, is what they were trying to communicate.
Well, I think Paul Simon raises the level of the marketplace. I think he's very much a product of a time when the song was what mattered most, and the idea of the song and the ability to play it and to sing it. And from then on, he's just looking for ways to be contemporary. You know, I think the idea of selling out is ridiculous. I mean, I think this is the kind of thing that people who aren't musicians like to talk about. But musicians know that if you make a song and nobody listens to it, it's the same as having not made it. The desire to communicate is what drives musicians. And you have to adjust to the marketplace at times. He's done that a number of times in his career and done it very well and has never pandered. He's always challenged us to go where he's gone. And inevitably, at least for me, going there has been satisfying.
And then finally, before we check out, it strikes me that I didn't ask you if there was like a specific track or two that you would like to talk about from Graceland. I mean, because it's nice when my commentators can point us toward a sort of an annotated listen to a particular track that points out some of the elements they were talking about. Are there any that stand out there? That?
Well, I'm the song on Graceland. I love the title track. I just think it's really wonderful. It's a journey of a father and son looking to find a place where they can be together. And the concept of grace, he handles this really well by sort of disguising it as a song, in a song that you might think is about where Elvis Presley lives, but it's not. It's a song about living in a state of grace and doing it with your family. I think it's masterful the way he did that. I also think You Can Call Me Al is a wonderful song. And I think what makes it a wonderful song is the leeway he gave the bass player, Bakidi Kamalo, in that song. I remember the song was recorded on Bakili Kamado's birthday. And that little bass solo that comes, I think it's four bars long. It might even be two bars long. He let Bakidi Kamalo play it sort of as a thank you for the effort that he made on the album, but also congratulations for his birthday. And then they took the tape and reversed it. So the bass, what you hear is the backwards version of what Kamalo played during the session.
Are there any impressions from your, you finally got a chance to work closely with him, any impressions about the kind of person Paul feels like when you're with him?
No, because I understand that when you are, when I go to interview a musician, I understand the contract. They're not going to give me anything of themselves that isn't going to be germane to why we're together. Mm-hmm. So I can't say I know him at all. I just know that he was treated terribly unfairly during the Graceland period. I thought people tried to politicize something that was a work of art, and I thought he handled it with grace and with dignity. And I think that the South African musicians who worked with him had a life-changing experience and will forever be grateful for having the experience of working with him.
Yeah, I talked with Joseph Shabala, and he said just as much. It was very clear.
Well, you know, I mean, people accused Paul Simon of cultural imperialism, which is ludicrous. I mean, that would be like accusing Ray Charles of being a cultural imperialist because he plays a piano, or Charlie Parker because he plays a saxophone, you know, instruments that were not invented by African Americans or by Africans. This is sort of a ludicrous concept that people attempt to introduce into the artistic process. Musicians don't think about these things. They think about making great music that communicates profound thoughts.
Well, Jim, I really think this has been great. I'll just give you a last call if there's anything else that you put down in your notes or something that you wanted to toss my way.
Well, I think one of the problems with baby boomers is that we have a tendency to bring marketing and our personal experiences into our assessment of music. And I think that Paul Simon doesn't really get a fair shake from baby boomers. I think he's seen as somebody who is less than Dylan, less than the Beatles, less than some of the greats of his era. But I'd be very comfortable in making a bet that 100 years from now, he's understood to be maybe the best of the era in which we lived. Because his body of work is very strong, and it's built on that foundation of musicianship, distinctive point of view, and risk.
Very well put, Jim. Thanks so much.
Okay. Anytime, Paul.